These are the true stories of farmers, conservationists, sustainable ag advocates, and researchers dedicated to advancing public policies to achieve a sustainable farming and food system in the United States. Find out what happens when people take action and start caring for the land.
Well, this is Ron Cruz. Today is February 21. And videographer Jackie Monroe and I are here on the farm of Don Bustos, located north of the Santa Cruz River, not far from the town of Espanola, New Mexico. Don's farm has been in the Bustos family since the 1600s. Don, I'm really glad to be here to talk with you. As I mentioned before the interview, I like to start these interviews with the idea of really getting to know the people who helped form a lot of the policies that the farmers around the country are benefiting from today. But I like to start with a look back at your own background, even all the way back to when you were a little kid, on how you got interested in farming, why you got interested. It's pretty obvious that the family going back 1600s, why you were interested in farming. But I'd like you to describe it and up through your youth, and then we'll go on from there.
Sure. Thank you for interviewing me. And as you say, the farm is we live in Santa Cruz, and the name of the farm is Santa Cruz Farm. Well, I named it after the church, the Santa Cruz Church, and I named it after the Santa Cruz de la Cañada land grant, which was established, you know, over 300 years ago. I like to tell people we still farm the same land our ancestors farmed 400 years ago, and we still use the same rituals, and we still use the same traditions. We incorporate a little new technology that allows us to be economically viable. And that technology comes in the form of using solar energy for year-round production itself. So I'm really proud of that. I really am proud also that we're sitting on the land that belonged to my mom and belonged to my grandma. My mom's name was Trinidad. My grandma's name was Henara. And my great-great-grandma, Altagracia, lived just across the acequia from where I live right now. This land has always been in the women's side of our family. And it's because women always outlived the men. And through the history of New Mexico, there was always men would either go to die from different natural causes or the difficulties and stuff. And so the women outlived the men itself. My great-great-grandma, Altagracia, had three different husbands, and she outlived all of them. So you can see how women were really the ones that always have protected the land and really made it available for the future for our kids themselves. So I grew up with that kind of a feeling of the land is to protect, to nurture the next generation, because here's where we're going to be for future generations. I myself, one of the fondest memories I have, I grew up here. Then my grandpa on my dad's side, Avran Bustos, my dad was Frank Bustos, Francisco, and Avran Bustos just on the other side of the foothills. I grew up there also, and Grandpa Avran had an old mule. And I remember he'd be plowing down the field with the old mule, and he'd hit a little stump, and he'd wiggle that plow out and put it down, sweat would be coming off of his forehead. And the first thing he would say, he'd be taking off the hat, wiping it across the brow, and he'd be saying, "Ojalá, if the Creator wills it, it'll be." And then, ha! The mule would go forward, and we'd keep plowing. So this sense of belonging, this sort of spiritual kind of a connectedness has always been in our family. And I think that is what really binds me to the land, is I never feel more comfortable, or I never feel more secure. I've never felt more secure until I'm right here on the land, because it speaks to me, huh? Not just this land, but the whole area just speaks, and there's a certain kind of a connection. So it's, I call it just, you know, living in the moment and really appreciate what we have and learning how to live within those areas itself. So that's kind of like the memories I grew up with right here. I grew up right here across the field that you can see here. You can't see it, but we grew chili, we grew sweet corn, pumpkins. We grew a lot of native crops like lamb's quarters, purslane. All those were incorporated into a diet. My dad had a cellar, and the cellar's still there. My mom would pack food. We'd dry squash. The women would do like all the packing, the preserving, and the men would do the fields, the wood gathering, and the hunting itself. So I grew up in that real traditional kind of family that everybody contributed to the larger picture itself, the family, and then the community itself was engaged in that kind of an area. And that's where the acequias are the first form of democracy in the United States, but it's also a form of water distribution in New Mexico and across the Southwest. And part of it is bringing people together to do the common good for the community. And that was to maintain the acequias, or the distribution of water in different forms. So that's all being part of a family, being part of the community, and being part of the larger whole, and not just for yourself, but you're serving everything around you and making sure everything's safe. So those are the types of areas that I grew up in.
Nonetheless, from what I've read, when you were a young man, you left the farm for a while, didn't you? And were a carpenter?
Yeah. When I was growing up, I went to military school, and I went to military school down in Roswell at New Mexico Military Institute. And then I was just about to join the military, and the draft ended. So I go, my dad served in Korea, and my uncle served in World War II. And so our families always have served during times of crisis and need. But in that time, when there was no need for me to serve. So I left the military, the institute, and I left the training. I left area and came back to the farm, and I joined the Carpenters Union. Yeah, and I was in the local Carpenters Union for several years. I went through an apprentice program and became a journeyman carpenter. And then I think it was in the late 70s and the early 1980s when the recession hit and there wasn't a lot of work around the country and slow in building and constructions. I started to come to the farm more and more and help my mom and dad. They were getting a little bit older. There was trees coming on. You know how farms sometimes get in a little bit of disarray. And so I helped them clean it up, and I planted the alfalfa fields. And that really what got me energized back. And I started to migrate, even if I didn't know it instinctually, but I started to migrate more and more to the farm itself. So I had the fields all full of alfalfa. I'd be here, I'd be cleaning. And then one summer I planted a roll of cucumbers. And the cucumbers did so well that I had cucumbers and give them to everybody. And my mom goes, "Well, there's a farmer's market in Santa Fe. You should go to the farmer's market." Like, I'll go give it a try. I didn't have anything else to do. So I loaded up my truck and I had a little bit of red chili and I took my cucumbers to the farmer's market. I didn't even make enough money for the entrance fee. But what there was so many beautiful women there that I go, "I'm going to go back again." So it wasn't the money. It never is about the money. It's always about having a good time. So that's what really drawed me into farming again was, there's a little bit of money to be made, but there's more of a social aspect to be had, more of a community kind of an environment. And I think that's always something that I've always, that we've always been drawn to a little bit, is that social engagement, that community kind of, yeah.
And then when you gradually went from cucumbers, you just started getting a clearer vision of what to grow, and now you have something like, 70 crops you grow? And talk a little bit about what the farm has become today here.
Yeah. So out of that experience, I started watching and I started looking at different kinds of crops. I started growing sweet corn and pumpkins, and I would go to the farmer's market. I mean, in those days, the farmer's market was just barely taking off. And just the cool thing about that is that this whole thing about organic was coming up. So there was this whole movement or this kind of rumbling about being organic and how it's better for food and it's healthier. And I caught that wave. And that wave really demanded a diversity of products to be delivered at the appropriate growing conditions. So we were able to start to meet that demand a little bit more through this farm. And then we went to season extension. And that year, we'll talk about the USDA programs, but all those programs through on-farm activities and needs, we were able to translate those needs through organizations like the Rural Coalition, like the NSAC, like Sustainable Ag Coalition before them, NIFI, and all these national organizations. They helped us translate the needs of small farmers into language that could be adapted by USDA and then create the programs that impact us directly. So those kinds of things that really started to happen, the farming area, the pieces of the policy starting to come together, the articulation for the needs, and then the rise from all the people that wanted to eat healthy. I mean, that was really the motivation, is that people wanted to start eating healthy and they became aware of the importance of organic, natural, pesticide-free, chemical-free And then later it was organic, but all these things come out of, you know, what I call this on-farm innovation and discovery, and then starts the research and demonstration from there.
Yeah, and it's really a matter of both the incorporating both the traditions and the wisdom of how to use the water with increasingly the scientific methods. Sometimes this, your methods were ahead of the science, and sometimes the science helps that they're learning more recently helps you out, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I have a good example of that also, is that I wrote a small grant. So one of the programs I really like to cheer on or champion is the SARE programs, and Western SARE, because we live in the Western United States, the biggest region in the U.S., by the way.
I learned agriculture
program. Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. And so that's a federal program, and they have funding. And so I got a small SARE grant, Western SARE grant, and it was to put up solar panels, because what was happening about 20 years ago, I started to sell to the Santa Fe public schools. And what was holding me back is that there wasn't enough production in the middle of the winter, January and February. So we went, I used to build these little cold frames out of PVC pipe, and I'd put up plastic, and I'd be able to extend the season into December, and then it would get really cold and it wouldn't grow anymore. And then I wouldn't start up again till March. And the daylight would start, daylight was long enough, and nighttime temperatures were allowed for it. And anyway, came along the SARE program, and I learned about SARE. I attended a small workshop in Albuquerque on grant writing. You know, and this is part of, I'll go to that. Sounds interesting. And I went over there and I learned about the SARE program. I got a couple of grants from SARE, and then I wrote the one for the solar energy. And they gave me solar panels. I told them, hey, I got a brand new method, man. I'm going to grow food in the middle of the winter, growing nothing but, using nothing but solar energy. And I drew this little piece of plan out on a plywood, and then we drew it out on paper. And then I did all the plans. A plumber friend of mine came in and helped me do the plumbing schematics. And I wrote it and I sent it in. It got funded. Yeah, it got funded. It's amazing. We put up solar panels. I put the radiant tubes underneath the beds of the cold frames that we have now. And so the idea was to have hot water, heat it during the day, store it, and then circulate that hot water at night underneath the soil. That brings up the soil temperature. And then at night, we covered it with a polyester woven cloth. And then the plastic on top, so the plastic layer would freeze first. The plastic polyester woven cloth would freeze it, create two layers of air. And then the hot air being released from the soil at night from the solar exchange system, that hot air would be trapped underneath that layer of ice. So it's like an igloo, I tell people. We're able to grow lettuce. It'd be below zero, and we're harvesting lettuce at 10 o'clock the next morning, huh? Solar energy. So I went from $750 for a little tiny propagation greenhouse I have. It was 20 feet, it's 15 feet by 50 feet, $750 a month for natural gas, to 7 cents a day for my electrical and natural gas needs. Wow. So you talk about the savings, huh? So I did that at SARE, and then the Caldas Science Center, like you're saying, I'm trying to tie it back in how it works. So the Caldas Science Center, which are good friends of mine, those guys there, and they were looking at it, and they go, yeah, Don, it looks like it works. No, but, you know, we never did the research. I do all, yeah, but I'm not a researcher, you know, I'm just a farmer. So they were able to get a larger grant, and they were able to do the research. Yeah, and Dal Jimenez put up, I don't know how many cold frames he'll say, and he did. He's put up, I'd say, several hundred cold frames across New Mexico, and Steve and Charles, all those guys, they got grants, and they were able to do the research, and now, you know, they now are doing the exact day, what to plant, what, how deep, what the temperatures. It is so sweet to see them really follow up. And then the whole community all in northern New Mexico really thriving to meet the demands of production in Santa Fe, huh? And the local schools. That came off from right here, just saying, man, I need enough. The damn gas bill was too high and I couldn't pay it. So I had to figure out another way so I could grow food to pay the bills, huh? Yeah, 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 yeah. So I go, yeah, so that simple stuff.
Imagine that's been written up by somebody, because that's...
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's, for yeah, 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 for SARE, yeah, it's in SARE. So from there, I tell the joke that I wrote grants to SARE, and I think I got funded two or three times, and I go, oh, they finally got tired of getting my grants and funding me, that they asked me to sit on their committee. So I sat on the SARE committee for, I think, 4 years or 7 years, and then I became the chair, and I chaired the Western SARE for 3 years. Oh, no, so I came all the way from writing grants, a farmer, all the way to chairing the Western Sierra Committee.
Well, I will probably talk some more about this, but I think a lot of folks consider the Sierra program one of the most significant things of the of what became NSAC, of the work, the working groups and the campaign for sustainable ag, all that work that ultimately led to the Sierra program, and gradually in the hard work of FERD and others to keep enough money in it. That's always the struggle. It's still a relatively pittance of the USDA's research monies, but it's done so much good.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I champion Sierra, and I think that they should actually get the amount of money that they need to do it effectively. They're doing an effective job, but there'd be a threshold that they get more funding, and then it kicks them up to the next level where they can open up more research centers. So I think that they should continue to get funded even at higher levels. They're one of the only USDA programs, and I don't mean to be disrespectful to any of the other programs, but I think that they're one of the only ones. Well, there are one of the ones, there are several of them, but that really hit the ground, and they have an effective, all of them do, but this one has an immediate effect on the farms themselves, because part of it is applied research and demonstrations where farmers can actually see it as it's going on. It's not just researched and put on the shelf for another researcher to read and then build on it. Huh? This is work that's really done right on the field. And then the councils incorporate people from their regions too. So they're getting feedback what each region needs. Yeah, yeah. So I can go on to say. So the cool thing about SARE is the regions, and each region gets a certain amount of funding, you know, Ecofauna funding. And then the region and the council decides how that funding is used, and not somebody in Washington, D.C. or somebody that doesn't know anything about the region, because the Southwest and the West region is different than the Northeast or the Southeast region.
Right.
So those are pretty innovative ideas. Huh?
Yeah, so that was happening in the, like in the 80s, probably when SARE, the work started on SARE, I think, and maybe the about the 90 Farm Bill. I got it written down somewhere exactly what the chronology was.
Yeah. But
you were probably one of the earlier people involved in SARE. Were you a part of any kind of a contingent that actually helped get SARE itself funded or not?
No, I wasn't part of that. I was a little bit, but not directly, because at that same time, FERD and the Sustainable Ag Campaign, the national campaign, were holding these national leadership development trainings. And I got invited in several areas, but one was to Washington, D.C., and they showed us how to lobby. And in that packet, it had the SARE program, and it had the farm program, energy programs and stuff. So we would go to our senators and our congressmen with the packet and lobby for the programs. So that was one of the great things that I really got from the campaign itself.
One of the things they really that really happened that's so good were those farmer fly-ins.
Oh, yeah.
Where the farmers themselves would get trained. And they were a voice that really couldn't be ignored, even by people, legislators who might not agree with them on a lot of things.
Well, no, you go in there, and like me, I knew my Senator Domenici since I was a kid. Senator Domenici, what are you doing here, Don? Who let you in? And, you know, joking around, asking about my dad, and then Senator Udall and you know, all of these guys that have been there, and now Representative Lujan and Senator Heinrich and Representative, I can't say, she's going to shoot me because I can't remember her name, right? Yeah, it'll come back to me in the middle of the night, and I'll wake up and go, oh, I messed that one up. No.
Yeah. That's fine.
Also, you know, so it's neat to have those connections, and I think part of it was to get that confidence, to get over there and then show us the packets. Here's what you want to talk about. Here's how much money. And then if they could, I think they would send a NADE with us or a group of us, and they would be able to explain in detail, and they would give them the card, and then there'd be a more direct connection. Huh? So that went on, like I was saying, with a national campaign, with the Rural Coalition. And then after that, after learning all of that, part of the cool thing is myself, Rigoberto, which is executive director, Mappy, Lauro, Chuco, and I can't remember the other guys. We formed the National Immigrant Farmers Initiative. And that's a national nonprofit organization that works on immigrant and refugee issues relating to sustainable agriculture. And it's, we've been in existence, I think now about 8 or 9 years, and we've had programs all over the United States. It's because the way the Oxfam report mentioned several years ago, I don't know if you read that Oxfam report, but I remember because it had my picture in the book and I was quoted in it. That was cool stuff. But anyway, it was quoted as, you know, organic growers and small growers are like 2% of the population, and all the funding is going to these other people, and or we're 15%, but we are getting less than 2% of the funding. And then it talked a little bit about how all the farmers are getting older. And then it talked about the next population of farmers are going to be immigrants. You know, if we really want to look at life seriously, is there's going to be a lot of internal growth. But if we really want to feed ourselves in the way that we think is the right way, in a sustainable and healthy and economic way, then we need about, I don't know how many million new farmers to come in. So we need to engage this new migration of agriculturalists and engage them in a positive way so that they can become part of the system and not excluded and being taken advantage of. And then later on, you get chaos. Bring in, you embrace, and there's not as much, there's always chaos and differences. That's what makes it interesting, but not so different where we cannot figure our commonalities together.
I can't resist, you know, with the recent election of President Trump and some of the things that have been going on early in the administration around immigrants, it must be hard for you to hear some of those things, I would think.
Yeah, it does. It sends chills, and it's you know, over the days and weeks, you know, you have to learn, like I say, you live in the moment, and right. You learn how to work, because wherever there's challenges, there's opportunities too. So we have to always look about ways that we're going to work on things. But it is concerning. It is concerning that there's a whole kind of an attitude, not only from our leader at this time, our president, but there seems to be a whole demographic that has been more emboldened, if I may say so, to express feelings that maybe aren't, I don't know. I really don't understand why people feel so emboldened to be so, I'm not sure what I'm looking for. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I know, to put it on a different slant on it, you've had a lot of work and been a part of the beginning farmer and rancher program too, right, with NSAC. And I imagine that came along late enough in the, or, you know, more recently, I should say, that you may have been probably a part of even the lobbying and effort to get those programs and to get them funded in a solid way.
Yeah. That was really, I was part of that one. And then they increased the other one too, were the programs through NRCS. You know, that's a whole program that was just started recently. And that was season extension, you know, because of what happens on the farm and people get the season extension. That whole program, I remember lobbying at it completely with the folks from, it's the Rural Affairs. What is it? The Rural Center for Rural Affairs. I remember attending them, and we'd be lobbying, and take me out there, and we'd be lobbying on those specific issues.
Chuck Hassebrook was one of the people I've interviewed earlier.
And then, the whole thing is just including limited resource and underserved people.
Right.
4 words is all we wanted to add. Right. You know, and it takes 12 years to add 4 words to a bill that allows for a certain demographic to be a specific group.
Right.
That's what I learned out of part of that, is you have to have patience. The first 4 years you're learning, second 4 years, things moving, you know, things don't happen until 12 years. It seems like 12, 20 years down the line, you're able to start to move policy a little bit more. Although Ferd had great success with SARE, but it's because he had a lot of experience and the things were just right when the SARE program came in. So he moved that along really quick, and we've all benefited from the work that's happened there.
Yes. I think in 12 years too, I know that the Organic Food Production Act was actually passed in 1990, but it took until 2002 before all of the work on the, what is actually organic and what isn't, the defining it and what materials could be used and everything. I think it was 2002 that it finally was really there.
Yeah, and that was because all the people called in to Washington. Remember, yes. All the phone calls, they packed all the lines, all the senators and congressmen didn't know what to do. It was because everybody stood up and said, we want this organic certification. I remember those days, people. So I have a story, and I don't know if you look it online or if anything is, I've been affiliated with this group called the Agrarian Elders. And it's Michael Abelman, Elliot Coleman, Jim, all these great farmers, Tim, Tim Nash, Life Power. You know, and they're all about my age, and I like to joke. So I sit on I support the the young, this is another group I give advice and counsel sometimes, and they invite me is the National Young Farmers Coalition. So when I go there, I'm the oldest guy there. And then I grow through the agrarian elders gathering, and I'm the youngest guy there. Like, all right, man, I feel good now. But, you know, we sit around and we talk, and we've had a couple of retreats and stuff, and we're trying to figure out, like you were asking earlier, I might be leading too quick, is what's the next step? Now, if I had to do it again, what we would look at, we'd do, I think, more about acquiring agricultural land for young people that need it. Because the way the system is set up now, it's all about, you know, it's, and I'm not sure how to put it, but it's about private ownership, where it should be more about people that are using and doing good things to the land should have access to the land. So how would we start to talk and change that concept? And I know there's conservation easements and all of this, but that and maybe more tweaking where people can actually get land for generations and improve it and hold on to it. And, you know, like the part of why we've had this land here for 400 years is because I know I don't own it. You know, that, I'm going to pass away here if I'm lucky in another, I'm 60. My goal is to live to 2050. So that'll put me like about 93 years old. So that whole thing is now Nettie, my niece, we're setting it up so that whoever is ready to take care of the farm will take care of the farm and my son when I pass away. And then from there on, it'll take care of them and their families for the next generation. You know, we're not going to hold on to it forever. So we never, my mom, my dad, and everybody, we never think of selling our land. I mean, that you sell your land, you're never going to get it back. You'll never be able to walk on it again. You'll never be able to grow a bean, anything. So that's why it's important to be able to have those federal programs in place that allow us to be successful to use our land and water for future generations. That's kind of why I got involved in the policy piece.
Good. And I want to talk a little bit about how you've taught and nurtured other beginning farmers too. Before we go there, I've tried to remember to go back to it. You've kind of referenced it, but another area that I know you've been a part of is sort of what called the civil rights struggle within agriculture, that for many years, the benefits weren't fairly distributed to the limited resource, or even probably more largely to people of color. And I know that was particularly too in the South, and a lot of good folks in there have been working on that issue. And there was ultimately some lawsuits, the Pigford suit, for example, and another one in this part of the world. Talk a little bit about that, your involvement in that.
So, you know, it's okay to say it, but USDA has always been, has always underserved the people of color and limited resource. And it's been blatant racism. And the black farmers had to put a lawsuit after years of being disqualified for loans or grants just because of the color and of their economic background. And they filed a lawsuit, Pickford versus USDA. And they went through years and years of litigation and then lawsuit settlements. And I know Ben Burkett and several of the other folks that were initiating that lawsuit. And USDA has always put, they're a lot better now than they used to be. Because I remember even in the 50s and 60s, we'd apply. And even as recently in the 1980s, I have a story that we were part of the Garcia versus USDA lawsuit because of what happened here. But there was blatant discrimination, and the USDA was sued. They lost the lawsuits, and there's monetary funding given out to the different minorities. If they qualify, if they can prove they qualify, then there's a settlement given out to help them continue farming. A lot of the black farmers and a lot of Hispanic farmers lost their land because they would go for a loan. They would say, oh, and they would say, there's no money, but the money would be going to the white farmers and stuff like that. And so the black farmer would go in and see it, and the white farmer would come in with the money on time and all the loans, and their crops would do well, and the black farmers or Hispanic farmers wouldn't get the loan. It was denied, and their crops would die. The land would shrivel up, and then before long, their land was up for sale, and the white farmer, you know, would get the land for pennies on the dollar. So that went on for years and decades, and then the lawsuits came through, and thanks to all the work like the Southern Law Poverty Center did and other groups worked on, the Federation of Southern Co-ops, And oh man, all those people, Shirley and Cynthia and Ben, they really led the group for all of us to really say, no, that's enough. No, we're going to stand up and fight USDA. So they really led the charge for not only themselves, but for Hispanics and later on women, because women have been discriminated by USDA for decades. Oh, there's just women, you know, just discriminate. They don't need the money. Where's your husband? I remember that story being told over and over. And then the American Native Americans have been discriminated, so their lawsuits. But what happens is you get the lawsuit, the U.S. government delays it, goes through courts, and then the people that originally, like Mr. Garcia, passed away before he never got to see anything and lost his land. Huh?
Wow, I saw that. One thing I read was that they finally did get the right year, by 2010, $1.2 billion was finally appropriated, but it wasn't until the Obama administration that some of that money started getting spread around. And now there's been something like, this might be a couple years old, 13,000 farmers who have gotten some money, and something like $1 billion has either been already given away or will be. So it's an ongoing process of trying to bring some economic justice to that situation.
Yeah, it's an ongoing process, but you know, I think that if that money isn't spent, it reverts back. So the longer they can delay it and push it back, then that money goes back to the government. So I guess I'm still like, you have to be careful. You know, I think it was Reagan, trust but verify. Uh-huh. Oh, we trust you, but let us verify. Let us check anyway. We trust you. So, you know, we trust USDA and everything. I'm sure everybody does, but let's just verify all the programs are being equally distributed. Everybody's given the same weight and all the process works correctly. Huh? Yeah, because a lot of people have been affected and are still affected by those activities that occurred as recently as the 1980s.
Yes, yes. Well, and I wanted to pick up on that.
So the Rural Coalition really did a lot. I don't mean to interrupt you, but the Rural Coalition did a lot of good work, a lot of with the NSAC, is to get this thing a receipt. So when you go into your office now, NRCS or FSA, not all the offices do, and you know, there's not enough enforcement anytime, but they're supposed to give you a receipt of services. At least you have proof that you went to that office and offered services, because paperwork can get lost, people can forget. And so at least there's a way to, and that was passed through the Rural Coalition efforts. That little piece of work, just a receipt of services, makes the difference.
Yeah.
Now if everybody can adhere to it, that'd be a different story, but at least it's in place.
Right.
Yeah, just little pieces. That's what I've learned a lot from everybody. It's, you know, somebody mentioned to me that USDA is like this great big battleship, huh? And it's out there in the ocean, and you can't just turn around. It takes like, I don't know how many days or hours it takes to turn it around. And that's like USDA. You know, you can do little things to tweak here and there, but to turn USDA around, I don't know. And then I think about it too, and I work with a lot of activists, and I don't think that anybody I know would like to see the collapse of USDA. Because I think it would collapse not only within USDA, but around the whole U.S. You know, USDA is not only food, it's forestry, health, nutrition, everything. So it would be, I think it would be disastrous to see it, but I could see where some programs continue to be shaped to support more economic growth and production of healthy foods and nutrition.
Well, and I wanted to hear too, now as I referenced a little bit ago, some of the things you've done coming out of not only the work that's federally supported on beginning farmers, but how you're serving as a mentor for farmers around here and really even more broadly than that.
So I've been really fortunate over the years, is that I guess I grew up with I grew up here on the farm with Grandpa and Dad, and my dad always would say that there's enough for everybody. And in Spanish, they'd say, hay pa todos, hay suficiente pa todos, mientras que no rebaten. There's enough for everybody as long as you don't get greedy and start to grab, huh? So that's always been my philosophy. There's enough for all of us to be able to be successful as long as we can all be successful together. So I've taken that same kind of a thinking into policy and into activity. Huh? When we started to develop the farmers market in Santa Fe, I was one of the founding members, and I had the vision, hey, we need it. Well, I had produce to sell, another necessity, huh? This is like, I can tell you how things get involved, is because I need them. I mean, I hate to be like that way, but we needed a market in the winter. No, the farmer's market was doing good in the summer. And then I learned how to grow in the winter. I was meeting some of the school demand, and then I need a little more income, and I had stuff, so I went to get the farmer's market. Anyway, the farmer's market started out of a need of year-round production. So we started from there. I lost track.
Well, and I wanted to talk then about how did you, I mean, one of the things that you've even gotten the James Beard Award, I have to mention that. That was a few years back now, right?
It's 2015.
Yeah. But one of the things they cited were those who influence and how we eat and those and affect those who grow the food we eat. And I wanted you. So there I think about the training that you provide or the mentorship that you provide.
So coming from my dad, thanks. I lost my thread. So coming from my dad of that sharing, I've always said that more is better. So, you know, I have a small farm, but if 10 of us can grow food and then we can sell it to a larger institution, that makes my market easier. So the idea is to grow more growers like ourselves so that we can have more access to markets. I don't see us being limited by the market. I see us limited by our growth potential itself. So out of that, out of sharing policy development, out of sharing growing methods, came the idea that if I can mentor more people, and it came out of just making friends more than intentional, the more like, hey, and now I'll mention Jose Luis because I, you know, Jose Luis and I, he's a good young kid in the South Valley. He's been working, I've been mentoring, working with me for about 7 years now. And he's really blossomed. He's a leader now in the community and he leads La Placita Youth Group. And they have people that are at risk and coming to the farm. They work a couple of days a week. He's working with the Native American youth programs. And so he's really a leader and training other people. But I would invite him to go in. So sometimes instead of going myself, I invite a friend, and that's kind of learning by osmosis occurs, huh? So you teach somebody, you hang out, hey man, why don't you go over there tomorrow and I'll be here. So you start to teach people, they start to get confidence. And that's where that kind of learning came in from the policy. So when I started with NSAC and all these other programs, I started taking people with me and they would start to learn. And now they're leaders within their communities themselves. Not so much intentional, but the results of sharing knowledge and sharing connections is not being afraid to share what we have instead of holding it, saying, this is my connection, I'm going to keep this, and here's where my power is. Now we share it with everybody and all of us advance together. Huh? So out of that, I started with AFSC and I started a farmer training program. American Friends Service Committee in New Mexico program. And I was the director for almost 14 years. I left the program now in August last year. But I started a training program to model the farm that we have here where there's year-round production, diversity of products, growing in a healthy way, and making enough money to pay the bills. Huh. The idea is that you got to make enough money to pay the bills. Otherwise, where are you going to do it? So we started the philosophy in the training. When our people come to the training program, we help them figure out how much do you need? You got to send your cool kids to college. You want to take a vacation. You want to save for retirement. Okay. Now we'll develop the farm to meet those needs. Instead of the farm being the driver, your lifestyle is the driver. So we develop the farm to meet those needs. Huh? And then the training program is learning by doing it. So the trainees get to hang out with Don for a full year, 3 days a week. Woohoo! Yeah, so we make friends, huh? We make stories, we make friends, and if I need help or they need help, we're there for each other for decades. And they start the training program. I start by, we do the, how much do you need? We do the farm plan, we do a business plan, and then we build a greenhouse for a cold frame on each individual's place, or we help them find land, because the idea is to help them get started. So if they don't have land, we help them find land that's available. We help them find the funding, put up a cold frame. So we practice putting up cold frames. We practice putting up drip systems. We practice farm planning, plan sequencing through the whole year. It's not just talk about it. We talk about it, let's do it. And then tomorrow, let's do it again. And then let's do it again until we practice it over and over. And then that's one full year of training, 3 days a week, at least 6 hours a day, 50 weeks a year. Because, you know, for Christmas and stuff, we need to
come. And is that what happens with the friends? And does that still continue? Do you still continue to do that?
That's still going on now. So that's still going on in some form or the other. That's still training program of passing on. So I learned from Heifer is passing on the gift. No. So you learn something and you get something and you help the next family get it. You pass it on. Huh? And that makes everybody feel good because you're able to teach your neighbor or your cousin what to do, and then they help them get started, and then they help the next person. So it's not a handout. It's about helping somebody else. No, it just changes that dynamic completely. No. And then you become the expert. Huh? Instead of having Don or George or somebody, you're the expert. So it really is empowering community, building leadership, and right within the community itself. So yeah, so the training program, I've done it for over 12 years. It started with American Friends Service Committee. The first USDA grant was a community food security grant I wrote. I wrote it twice, and I got once, I got rejected. Albino Garcia, the director for La Placita Institute, he's a, I don't know, you'll ever get to meet Albino, but he's a great guy. He's all a gang prevention, came from Los Angeles, lives in Albuquerque. And, you know, I met him because he was a local organization and I was looking for organizations. And he goes, Don, we don't do farms, man. We do gang prevention. And anyway, I talked him into putting a little farm. And I tell a story one day, I get off all track, but I'll tell a story one day. He came in with almost tears in his eyes. And we were at a meeting and I had the farm going. He came into a meeting. I go, Albino, what's happening? You're breaking down. He goes, Don, I just came from getting a kid out of jail, 13 years old. He got caught stealing food out of 7-Eleven. Albino went to the judge and told the judge, hey, I know this kid, let him out, because that's what Albino does now. The kid didn't have any money. His little brother and his grandma didn't have any food in the house. So he went to steal food from 7-Eleven and got caught and got thrown in jail. So that's where Albino goes, no, we got to learn how to grow food, man. And he started the slogan, let's sling tomatoes instead of guns. Yeah. And oh, I have a t-shirt now. I don't know if you probably know, I point to her, but the one that guns turned guns into plows. Oh yeah. So they did a whole program around that now in La Placitas in Albuquerque this last year between AFSC and La Placita. So now Jose Luis runs the training program for at-risk youth in the farm. And he was telling me just last year, they made money. They actually were able to pay the farm worker, buy their seeds, not money as a nonprofit, but enough money to cover their costs for the operation of the specific farm program, not all the program, but just the farm program itself. Yeah. So we take that whole training program like that, and we train people how to become leaders, how to get active. So in New Mexico is like the cadre part of it is when they go through our training program, they don't not only about farming, but they look about community. So one of the things we do is we do legislative training. We bring them up to the legislature. We give them a packet. We already introduced them to their representatives and their senators. When the session's going on now, we'll go and we'll visit with them. We'll tell them, Representative, and we're really working with Representative Gallegos down in the South, because they're building the farmer's market in Anthony, New Mexico. They're building a facility like the Santa Fe one, and the Senator Cisneros, Senator Cervantes, and Representative Gallegos have both put state funding and some federal money from grants are already going to build a facility. So these guys from Anthony, her constituents, will drive up and we'll go as a group and we'll meet with a senator and the representatives. And then last week, we all got to, well, I didn't get to because I'm already an old guy, but they got to sit on the Senate floor. Yeah. So their senator got to introduce him and acknowledge him. Hey, these are my constituents and they're building a farmer's market. I just wanted you guys to be here and treat them friendly. That's what it's about. It's breaking that ice, making them feel like they're wanted. Their ideas are not. They know we're just accompany them on that journey to being more empowered. Huh? Yeah. That comes from sharing. You know, and we're not going to do it ourselves, man. We got to do it all together.
Well, and we're. I don't want to go too much longer for you, but I really appreciate all the learning about all you've done and these very interesting stories. I'd like to end then with picking up on. What you think, you've touched on a lot of things that obviously have to go forward, but what do you think is the biggest challenge and has to be met and people ought to be working on towards the future for a better food system and a better care of the land, those kind of things?
So I grew up here, as always, I've said that, and the most important thing here is water. Land and water and culture, but water, without water, we can't do anything. So we really have to learn how to manage our water in a really effective manner, because we can see in the rural communities in New Mexico and the Southwest, there's a big urban development and that's taking water from the rural communities that I don't know why there's this disconnect about, you know, water needs to go to cities and not grow food. Not a complete disconnect, but people aren't, they're there, but they're not quite there. So there's still this kind of a whole discussion about what's a carrying capacity of the environment in the region that we're in. And once we can define the carrying capacity and everybody can agree to it, then maybe we can come up with a solution that allows us to continue within a sustainable capacity for future generations, or else we'll start to go down that pathway as a collapse. You know, that whole book, Collapse. I can't, he's the doctor. Diamond, you know. I read that whole, you know, there's several, all sorts of people talk about if we don't, or write and research and understand if we don't take what's here, take care of what's here, then our society and all future societies are bound to collapse or have chaos that sometimes isn't the best result of, because we're just mismanaging or we just don't understand what's occurring. So that around water, that whole management of our natural resources is like, so there's that. And then there's this whole thing about supporting and engaging more production in healthy farms in the United States and across the globe. So if I understand it, the majority of the world, not the majority, or maybe so, have small farms and they sustain themselves. In the U.S. and other developing countries, mega farms, commodity farms are developing the food and they're supplying the food through technologies that some of us all don't agree and have proven since the 1960s and the Green Revolution not to really work. You know, that was the silver bullet, you know, and now we're finding out that isn't the silver bullet because it displaced cultures, broke economies, and the commodity crops aren't that healthy anyway. And it's so we found things that are going on. So how do we set up more ability for adults and young farmers that want to access land and water and allow them to grow food in sustainable manners to feed the populations of our country?
It seems, and I have to bring this up, neither of us have quite brought up climate change, you know, and in that challenge is how do we do that while still meeting the challenges the environment will likely bring through climate change too. And it seems like, and I think you would agree, that many of the people I interview feel like looking towards as natural systems as possible is at least one good strategy for try to deal with the inevitabilities of climate change.
I think that that definitely is the, what they call the elephant in the room, huh? Because that's what's going to affect all of us, climate change. We see it right here now. Well, you can see in a beautiful day like today, it's almost, close to 70, I bet. And it shouldn't be this warm. So we have a good snowpack now. But the last 5 or 8 years, we've had a heat rise in our climate. So all the snow will be melted by July and August. The runoff will be gone. We'll go into the hot part of the months without very little rain, and no snowpack. Those are all indicators of climate change. A lot of the big cottonwood trees that you see along the river, a lot of the pests that are occurring into the forest, the tree beetles and all these are all caused by climate change activities. So, you know, to me, it's like we have to really start to think about how we're going to address it in the future. And I think, and I don't like to boast, or I don't like to really think about it, but I think a lot of it is still being developed on the farm. You know, people that are growing the food every day or harvesting the forest or fishing or ranching, because the ocean and the fish are just as important to talk about as the land. You know, and a lot of times we in agriculture get caught up, well, farming or agriculture, we're growing something, or is the forest, but there's the whole ocean fishing that is occurring, and a lot of people are integrating these kinds of systems, sustainable systems, into the harvest of marine animals and fish. So, but I don't know, man. So I say, I always like to, you know, I'm always looking for opportunities. So our cold frames, we're getting ready for that climate change. We're going to grow lettuce in January, and our greens, our produce are going to grow in the winter. And in the summer, we'll just grow cover crops and adapting as long as we can keep our water. So that's why it's so important to preserve our water, because without water through these climate changes, you know, studied over the globe, that's what affected agriculture more than anything over centuries, you know, over thousands of years, it's been the water. So we really, that's why I go back. We really got to manage our natural resources in an effective way. And not to go off on a tangent or anything, but I grew up, you know, here, and my dad's saying was that As long as you can grow beans, squash, your chili and your corn, mijito, the whole world can go to pot and you'll be okay. And I still live from that philosophy, is that as long as we can take care of our land and our water and grow our food, we and our community will be okay. So that we're not a global dependent on people growing our food. And, you know, I visited China and I've learned from Chinese farmers, Korean farmers. I've been all over the world, all over Europe. I think I've only been two continents, Africa, Antarctica, I haven't been to. I've been all the rest. And I think that that whole idea of this farming community is more important.
Good. Well, I think we've covered almost every topic. I can always listen to more of your stories, but if you've got anything else you want to add, otherwise, I'm very satisfied that we've caught a lot of what you brought and the reason you've gotten the awards and accolades that you have.
Thank you. I hope it's what you were looking for. Sure. I ramble a lot, so you might
know. The rambles is where a lot of the wisdoms come through, as far as I see it. So I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. You know, make sure that everybody knows that me and I really appreciate it, and I think all the farmers, I really appreciate all the work NSAC, the Rural Coalition, NIFI, all of these organizations that have really supported grassroots, underserved, limited resource, and people of color throughout the whole USDA farm process.
This has been part of the National Sustainable Agriculture Oral History Archive, produced by Ron Cruz, available on the Minnesota Institute for Sustainable Agriculture website. The podcast was made possible by the Center for Rural Affairs.